2017 has been turbulent for Mexico, thanks in part to the new occupant of the White House. From NAFTA negotiations to presidential elections, there's much at stake in the coming year as well. This is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online reporting from Mexico City, where I spoke on these issues and more with Victor Herrera, the former head of Standard & Poor's here in the capital.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Thank you very much for talking with me today, Victor.
Yeah, thank you.
So I want to start with NAFTA. Given that there's a new round of talks this week, there's a general sense that things may not be going so well. And some have even suggested that we could be seeing the demise of NAFTA. What do you think? And what would it mean for Mexico if the agreement fell apart?
Well, when all of this process started, being a big renegotiation of a very complex agreement, we all knew that the point could come when somebody could just stand up and leave the table, no? And every good negotiation has those moments coming. Mm-hmm. And especially when it's a three-party agreement, one or two parties can just stand up and leave, no? And especially when you have a very, very dominant one, which is the United States, because of its deep, deep market and the amount of exports that Canada and Mexico have to the U.S., about 80% each. Obviously, that creates imbalances in the negotiation that bring us to a point where someone can stand up and just throw everything in the table and go out. And when that happens, you have to keep a cool mind. Markets don't always have a cool mind. But when that happens, these parties can sit down and talk again, no? Mm-hmm. And it's part of a very common trade in negotiations where that happens not once or twice, maybe even three times, no? Mm-hmm. The problem is that now we are running against the clock. Because Mexico has a schedule that you have to approve this thing before the next year's election. The U.S. has a schedule. You have to approve this thing before congressional elections next year. The only one who's not under pressure right now is Canada. No?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And one thing that I think some people don't necessarily realize in the United States, and potentially people who might be critics of NAFTA, is that they don't realize how much NAFTA has fundamentally changed Mexico. And I think one thing you can say is if you're in Mexico City and you walk into a shopping mall here in Mexico City, oftentimes it can feel like you're walking into a shopping mall somewhere in the United States. Let's say that NAFTA did end. What do you think that would mean for Mexico? It doesn't seem like we can go backwards. So what would happen?
Well, Mexico stands to lose a lot, no, because of the flows of investment and potentially losing access to one of the biggest markets. And it depends on how big it is, because if you pull out of NAFTA or the U.S. pulls out of NAFTA, Mexico would then fall under the World Trade Organization rules, which are not that bad. I mean, it's only like 2-3% taxes that go to of products that go into the United States. But if the U.S. puts additional tariffs on that, then it can create a big problem. No, let me give you just an example of what would happen from the Mexican point of view. Mm-hmm. Over half of the products in a Mexican supermarket are imported. Mm-hmm. And they're imported from the U.S. and from Canada. Mm-hmm. If the agreement dies overnight, this is going to have an impact on the daily lives of a lot of people, because all of a sudden there's going to be a scarcity of almost everything that we consume in Mexico, especially on foodstuffs. Mm-hmm. So the government would have to scramble to import from other sources, especially Brazil and Argentina, beef and grains, to avoid these shortages in the country, no? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that they are planning for that eventuality right now.
You know, we've also seen that Mexico's president, Peña Nieto, was recently in China, and we've seen the growth of the Pacific Alliance. What do you make of those types of trips to Asia? What do you make of the Pacific Alliance? To what degree can those agreements or those types of partnerships replace NAFTA, and to what degree can they not?
So obviously, there's no way to replace the U.S. market overnight with other markets. This is a long-term effort that's going to take many, many years to even substitute part of that market. And the thing is that, imagine if all of a sudden Poland or Hungary shut down their trade with Germany. Mm-hmm. You cannot find a replacement overnight. It's going to take many, many years. And it's a good thing that the Mexican government is doing that. Hopefully the private sector will start doing it too, because exports are not driven by the government sector. They're driven by the private sector. And the private sector in Mexico has not been very good at diversifying markets in the past. So the thing is that what would happen is, either if we break NAFTA, or the U.S. breaks NAFTA, and if we fall into the World Trade Organization's rules without additional tariffs, there would be an adjustment period, but trade would continue. Mm-hmm. If new tariffs are imposed, which is the scary part, mm-hmm. we can potentially fall into a trade war. Mm-hmm. And that could expand. And there are certain examples in history where trade wars started without being very significant, or and all of a sudden they spread like a burning wood. Mm-hmm. It's a very dangerous scenario.
And would you give an example of that in terms of Mexico, or when you say in history, what would be an example?
Well, the clearest example, and it's very amazing how similar the situation is in 1930, a U.S. senator called Reed Smoot and a representative, Willis Hawley, created the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act to protect the U.S. industry from imports from other nations, and they increased taxes to about 20,000 products. That tariff act is credited for exacerbating the U.S. depression, mm-hmm. okay, and the world depression by itself, because that triggered a lot of trade wars, and it started with Canada, ironically. Mm-hmm. And then it went with England and with Germany and with France. So it's a very tricky issue when you start playing around with taxes to protect your own industry, no? And we have that example less than 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm, right. And one of the things that has been discussed, you know, there's talk about if NAFTA just falls apart, and then there have been talks about if we would move to bilateral agreements. So what do you think of that? What would that mean for Mexico if it had to make an agreement just with Canada and make a separate agreement with the United States?
Well, if it were a bilateral agreement that could have that flexibility to move products, that could potentially do it. Although, you see what's happening right now with Bombardier and with Boeing. That's a bilateral agreement there, mm-hmm. no? Or with softwood lumber in Canada, or the dairy products, or with steel. Those are bilateral agreements that are not going that good, no? Mm-hmm. So the best way to pave the road for long-term trade development is to have an agreement such as this one. Mm-hmm. That could be updated, not every 5 years, because every 5 years is a very short time frame, no? Mm-hmm. But constantly, no? I mean, NAFTA has been updated 3 or 4 times already since in the past 23 years. No?
Mm-hmm. And when you say every 5 years, you're referring to the sunset clause?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Just imagine if you're a developer of a resort and you want to build this big property in a county that tells you that every 5 years the land license is going to be reviewed or canceled, mm-hmm. you won't invest there. No, mm-hmm. You have to have long-term certainty with long-term investments.
Right, right. And, you know, we talked a little bit about other types of agreements. You know, Mexico, as part of its change over the years that it's been a part of NAFTA, it also has agreements with over 40 countries around the world. It's this trade pacts give it access to over 40 countries around the world. So what does that mean for Mexico as a market? How does that make Mexico different and from other?
Well, obviously it makes it very attractive because we have cheap sourcing of parts from the US and Canada and Mexico, and we have low-cost manufacturing here that make products competitive elsewhere, no? But there, let me give you two examples of export markets from Mexico that have gone wrong, no? Mm. One, obviously, without a free trade agreement is Brazil with the cars. Mexico signed an agreement with Brazil some years ago it was the beginning of a free trade agreement. The Brazilians were okay while they had a trade surplus, but at the moment that Mexico had a trade surplus, especially in cars, they shut down the import of cars, or they contained the import of cars to Brazil. Mm-hmm. That didn't work very well, no? And just to tell you how markets work, Renault shut down its plant in Brazil because of that. It didn't come to Mexico. Mm-hmm. It opened up in Colombia, in Medellin, mm-hmm. because they started building these SUVs there. And Colombia is not the best place to invest in because of the logistics are very complicated and very, very expensive. But they went there anyway, no? But Mexico has a free trade agreement with Colombia. So the other example I wanted to give you is that Mexico is also very good at building trucks. And they started exporting trucks to Colombia, something like $800 million a year, until the Colombians said, no, we don't like that many Mexican trucks. They put tariffs on it, and now trade in trucks has gone down to about $5 million. You know? Mm-hmm. So even when you have a free trade agreement, things may not be going that well. No? Mm-hmm. And that's why you have to have very clear rules that work in the long term in order to avoid this type of mishaps.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Great. Well, one of the things you mentioned is also that there's a timeline for this. One of the reasons of the elections next year here in Mexico. You just recently wrote an article for our publication, America's Quarterly, about Andrés Manuel López Obrador, a former Mexico City mayor, three-time presidential candidate, seen by many as a leftist populist. And there's a lot of speculation about whether this time, next year, the 2018 elections, whether third time's a charm. And you make the case in the America's Quarterly article that it won't be because he doesn't necessarily have the number of votes you need in order to win. And the portion that you gave, now, one thing just for anyone who's listening and doesn't know, unlike many Latin American countries, Mexico does not have a second round in elections. So someone doesn't have to win 50% of the vote in order to win the election and become the next president. Next year, we're looking at some divided parties. We're looking at some new parties. And there are more than, as I understand it, more than two dozen independent candidates. A lot of them are small independent candidates, and we'll see if they get the signatures and whether they really run. But some of them are big names. The governor of Nuevo León, El Bronco, and former First Lady Margarita Zavala. And what I'm curious about is, you put out the figure that you think someone will need about 35% of the vote to win. Now, is there a possibility that it could be even less? Given that you have so many different hats being thrown in the ring, how do you get to that 35% figure?
Well, it could be a little bit less, not much less than that, because you need some volume in order to gain traction in the elections. If it's 32 or 33, I mean, it's between 30 and 35%. No? Mm-hmm. But yeah, you are right. If the more candidates there are, the more diluted the vote will be. Mm-hmm. And you need a lower percentage to win. Mm-hmm. And that's why, if that under that scenario, you have to have a very good electoral machine that generates these votes for your party at a national level. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the PRI has one and mm-hmm. has been working well for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. The PAN has one, but it's making every effort to break it apart. Mm-hmm. And the PRD has one. And we saw one, we saw it in the State of Mexico elections where they came in third with a good candidate, no? And that was the biggest surprise, no? Morena, on the other hand, has a very strong presence in certain regions, but not a national level, no? So it is very important to attract these forces that have dominated elections in the past towards your own objective, no? And that's why I'm mentioning in that article that whoever really wants to have a chance at it, they have to start building alliances very quickly, no? Before the campaign starts, because, and they have to be very strong alliances, because this is going to be a very contested election. The stronger agreement you have with other politicians, the better chance you will have to get to the objective, to your mm-hmm. ultimate yeah. goal. No?
Now that we're looking at some of these big independent names, do you think that having more independents is going to help the governing PRI, or do you think it's going to help AMLO?
No. I think that the more independents we have, the bigger the chances for the PRI to come out winning. And the more independents, the less chance, the more diluted the vote for the opposition will be if you consider AMLO the stronger opposition as the candidate right now. Mm-hmm. A vote for El Bronco would be a vote against the PRI, right? Mm-hmm. But it also would be a vote against AMLO. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why the situation with Margarita Zavala is so important, because the PAN has already beaten the PRI twice, you know? And they know how to do it, but right now they're totally divided. And by having Margarita run as an independent, that's going to dilute not only the PAN, but it also can strengthen the PRI's position to win. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one other thing I wanted to talk about that's a big issue in Latin America and has been in Mexico and is related to elections is corruption. Because there, in spite of the fact that as we look at the breakdown in terms of candidates, it looks as though the scenario could benefit the PRI. At the same time, there's been a lot of discontent with the government. We saw it with the earthquake. It came out that Mexicans were very supportive of each other, but there was a big expression of discontent about the government, concerns about corruption and how that might have even played a role with some of the deaths and some of the buildings falling. That's not necessarily party specific, of course, but I wanted to get your view on that. You know, Transparency International just came out with a new report that didn't paint Mexico in a great light. How do you think corruption affects the country's economic outlook? And do you think that discontent over it means we're reaching some kind of turning point in the country?
Well, corruption has always slowed down Mexico's development. Maybe growth could be one percentage point higher if we had better accountability and more transparency, but we don't, and that's obviously a drag in economic growth. And yes, the answer to your second question is yes. The more we talk about it, the more action there will be to contain it or to control it going forward. This is a long-term process. Corruption has been rooted in our culture for many, many, many years, and it's going to take many years to pull out of it. No, and look at what's happening in Brazil. Brazil started; they're beginning to make progress in it, but it looks like it's an endless situation. No, and it's going to happen here when we start doing something like what Brazil does. There will be the impression that it's never ending corruption, and it's everywhere, and it is. And we have to start someplace to start correcting it, no? And the more we talk about it and the more these things come up to light, the more legislation and the more control there will be to avoid these practices in the future. But it's going to take a very long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We've talked about some really big issues affecting Mexico. And I'm wondering, what do you consider to be big issues that often get overlooked in Mexico in terms of economic outlook, in terms of investments? What are the things, everybody's talking about NAFTA, everybody's talking about the elections next year. What aren't people talking about that you think they should be?
Well, you know, President Zedillo put it very clearly in a couple of his speeches some time ago, and the constant issue that we heard from, and it's related to many of the topics that we're talking about, is rule of law. Mm-hmm. And if Mexicans don't obey the laws and there is no consequence for breaking the law, then that's going to be reflected in trade transactions, in business transactions, in elections, and it's going to hurt the country eventually, no? If you go in the street and you run a red light and nothing happens, then someone else is going to do it again. And at the end, you're going to have chaos in the streets. And look, you can look at this city or any other city in Mexico, and you see nobody respects traffic lights. No, mm-hmm. It's basically the same thing with other areas in the economy. You know, if you don't respect the funding for the funding limits on parties, then you're going to have in the problems that we have in elections. If you don't respect the law with business contracts, then you're gonna delay. If you don't pay your debt and nothing happens, and it's gonna take 5 years for the bank to take over your home or your car, then there's not gonna be enough credit flowing to the private sector. And those are the things that we have to correct in the long term. In terms of compliance with law and order. No? And that's probably the biggest thing where Mexico has been hurting for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's a very difficult endeavor to correct, because you have to change not only the mentality of people who are willing to corrupt themselves by bribing an officer, but also you have to change the mentality of the judges and the courts in order to make the application of law more expeditious and more transparent, no? And mm-hmm. and it's Zedillo started doing that by knocking out all of the Supreme Court, but he never had a chance to go to the other courts and clean them up, no? And to change the judicial way of the judicial procedures. Mm-hmm. We have to work on that in order to fix many, many of our problems. Mm-hmm.
There are some steps that have been taken, and some of them have come with other types of controversy, right? So like a national anti-corruption system, some different types of judicial reform. As you mentioned, as you already said, in terms of corruption, things are going to take a long time. Do you see some of these steps as being part of that long process? Do you think that those are going to help the country get closer?
Yes, they are. But the biggest thing that can help this process move faster is when you have someone in the street just picking up their phone and filming an act of corruption. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that you can put light into that act of corruption is going to continue it in the future. It's going to make it more difficult, no? Mm-hmm. So I'm optimistic on that point, because the more we talk about it, the more we see it, the more embarrassment you bring to the people who fall into it. And not only the people who receive the bribe, the person who gives it, no? Mm-hmm. They're equally as guilty, no? Then that's going to help control it in the future.
That's great. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me. Really Thank interesting stuff.
Thanks for listening. For more, visit as-coa.org.